I'm Lee Armstrong. I'm the assistant to the director at the Wheelwright Museum of the American Indian, and I'm writing a biography about Mary Cabot Wheelwright.
I'm so glad you're doing that because it's really hard to find information about her. Let's talk about when Mary Cabot Wheelwright came to New Mexico, because she would come back and forth from Boston.
The first time we think she was out here in the Santa Fe area was probably about 1918. It was after her mother died in 1917, and she came out for a visit. And at that time, Carol Stanley was actually married to Richard Fofley, or Foffle, depending on how you pronounce his name. They were starting their Dude Ranch business, which ultimately became San Gabriel Ranch, and Mary stayed at San Gabriel Ranch in Alcalde on several occasions before purchasing her home, Los Luceros, in Alcalde. She, you know, always traveled with companions. She never really traveled on her own She was single. She'd been born in that Boston society that gave her a certain stature in the community because of her socioeconomic background. And she would utilize that to her advantage, as her interests in Native Americans and Navajo spirituality in particular became evident. And then her next big adventure out here was probably 1922-23. I'd love to be able to give you an exact date, but this woman didn't write a diary. Or if she did, it never came to the museum. So we have to sort of piece things together about who she was with, what she's talking about. And this 22-23 visit, she talks about being at San Gabriel. So Carol and Richard would have been running it by then. And then Francis Newcomb, she and her husband ran a trading post in what's now Newcomb, New Mexico, recorded that Mary first met Hosteen Klaw in 1923. Oh. So the interest in Santa Fe, you know, because of the Burson Bill and the great outcry by the artistic and literary community that was here in Santa Fe against the government trying to dispose of Pueblo lands, really made Santa Fe a hotbed of interest if you were interested in Native American things, if you wanted to pursue that. The artists had been here for a number of years. They were familiar with other artists who had come out here. For example, William Penn Hallow Henderson in 1916, he and his wife Alice Corbin, the poet, came out here because of her health, and they lived at Sunmount because she had tuberculosis. So that whole creative community sort of coalesced here, and they became very welcoming to other artists, other writers, and people that actually had an affinity for New Mexico and Native Americans. The popular belief at that time was really based on what the United States policy towards Native Americans had been, which was pretty much extermination. Round them up, put them on reservations, keep them away from their traditional lands. But here, things had become a little different. When the Navajos were forcibly removed to Bosque Redondo between 1864 and 1868, they actually became the first Native American tribe to be able to return to a portion of their traditional homelands. Mm-hmm. The Pueblos being so close, and the interaction between individuals here that were interested in watching the dances or attending ceremonies, if they were permitted to do so, really made this one of those places that became very special to a lot of people, and still does today.
Explain what the Burson Bill was.
Holm Burson was a senator from New Mexico, and they tried to arrange to renege on treaties that had been entered into between the United States government and the various Pueblos in terms of their land. They were going to let any white settlers that had encroached on these territories that were supposed to be specifically for the Native Americans, they were going to let them live there. And the community here in Santa Fe and elsewhere in the United States became outraged and actually succeeded in stopping it from happening. But the big issue in 1922 was the Burson Bill, which actually resulted in the founding of the Eastern Association on Indian Affairs and the New Mexico Association on Indian Affairs, as well as groups in the Federation of Women's Club and other organizations throughout the country that worked hard to start consolidating Native American rights in the country.
Okay. How old was Mary Cabot Wheelwright when she started coming to New Mexico?
Well, she was born in October 1878, so she would have been in her 40s, which was a popular age for a lot of people, for a lot of single women to venture out to Santa Fe. It certainly was for me. I moved here when I was 40, 45. So with her Boston heritage, she was a very dutiful daughter. As an only child, her parents married much later in life than normal for Bostonians. So she grew up in this sort of cosseted family situation. And she was a dutiful daughter until after both of her parents passed away, and then she really could do what she wanted to do. She inherited a modest amount of money. It wasn't nearly the amount of money as some of the other people that were out here. I mean, she didn't have the kind of money that Amelia Elizabeth White and her sister had. It wasn't that kind of money. But she was well off. I don't mean to imply that she was poor mm-hmm. by any standpoint. But her money was all tied up because she was a woman, and the male cousins in the Wheelwright line had control of her money. And it becomes a running theme through her existence about
trying to get
money from the family and them complaining about how frivolous she was.
Oh, wow. Okay, so when she first would make those couple trips out here, then would she start going, and she got Los Luceros. When was that?
In 1923.
Okay, that was early.
Yeah, it was very early. And Los Luceros was really just north of the land that Carol and Richard Foffel had for San Gabriel Ranch. Mm-hmm. And that was really a dude ranch that catered to single women from the East. Mm-hmm. Carol was from Massachusetts as well. And you probably should try to talk to Leslie Poling Kempis sometime. Yes. She's as obsessed about Carol as I am about Mary. And we share our obsessions every once in a while. So Mary then would start coming out here. She purchased Los Luceros. Carol renovated it for her and worked to purchase furnishings and for, and this is the big house there. And then Mary would come out generally twice a year.
Oh, that was my question.
She never stayed here year round. So she would come out in the late fall or early spring, late winter, early spring. She'd stay for maybe 3-4 weeks at a time. The longest that she ever stayed in a calendar year was like 8 weeks one time, which was an exceptional thing. And you have to think about her. She's traveling from Boston. She comes out here. And then she's got to travel back. Mm-hmm. When women stayed at San Gabriel, they could take camping trips. They had cowboys who would take them camping. They could go to the pueblos to see the artists or to attend dances. They could go on longer trips to the Navajo Reservation. And it was on an early trip to the Navajo Reservation, 1922-23, that she first met Arthur and Frances Newcomb, who ran a trading post in Newcomb, New Mexico. And they ultimately introduced her to Hosteen Klaw, who was a Navajo ceremonial singer.
I haven't been able to find enough about Mary Cabot Wheelwright to have a sense of what her personality was. Do you like her?
Most of the time I like her. And I certainly could not have been dealing with this biography this long if I didn't really like her, I guess. Although it's time for her to move out of my house. She was opinionated. She certainly expected people to do her bidding. I would not characterize her as mean, although I'm sure some people probably saw her that way. But she had expectations of how you would behave and how she would be treated.
Oh.
And that really is based on the Boston business. However, at the same time, there are reports that she would go camping. And I mean, camping in New Mexico is not easy. And we have photographs of her out in the middle of nowhere in one of those horrible old World War I surplus tents that must have weighed 8,000 pounds to try to put up. And she's out there, and there's nothing for miles, and Jack Lambert was one of the cowboys that took her on camping trips, and he said she never complained. Mm. And there were other occasions where she and Frank Newcomb went out to the reservation. This was when they were gathering Navajo ceremonial information. And they would be in less than clean and less than comfortable circumstances, and Mary wouldn't complain. She would not, you know, she would neither belittle the where they were staying or the people that they were with or the conditions. So I think she had that sort of almost a split personality in a sense. When she was at her house, she wanted things done her way. When she was out, she was more accepting of this is the way life is here.
Okay, so she met Hosteen Claw, and eventually they both became the founders. He was kind of the inspiration for being the founder of the Wheelwright Museum.
Yes, you know, I mentioned before that the concern out here was that tribal customs and the tribes themselves were going to disappear, and that was based on what everything that had happened in the East with tribes that didn't exist anymore, with other tribes being forced onto reservations and virtually exterminated, and their cultural heritage being so severely limited. Frank Newcomb, Frances, and I always call her Frank because that's what she preferred, and she spelled it F-R-A-N-C, and she wrote a book about Hosteen Claw that's still published and available for people to read. Mm. She and Arthur married and went to the trading post in like 1917, I think, and they became friends with Hosteen Claw, and Frank really became interested in Navajo spirituality. Mm-hmm. And was very purposeful in encouraging Mary to follow this path. Now, Mary was a Unitarian, so she certainly did not believe that God was limited to one form and one way of thinking. And her family were involved with the Transcendentalists. So she had that whole sense of how wide you could look at religion. It was not a small thing, it was a big thing. And I think that made her very receptive. Today, we would consider her a student of comparative religion. Mm-hmm. But at that time, she had no formal education the way we look at education now. She was tutored and raised by governesses and probably attended neighborhood schools, which were symptomatic of Boston society for young girls at that time, you know, going to a what we would consider an elementary school or a high school or a private school. That just wasn't what some of that class did. Other members did go to colleges, but Mary didn't. And that certainly was a stumbling block for her with anthropologists that she met later on in her career, because they didn't see her as having sufficient education to compete with them. Oh. And primarily men, but there were a couple of women too that felt that way about her. When she is out here in this 1922-23 visit, Frank Newcomb talks to her about, well, what are you going to do? You have some wealth, you have all this time, what are you going to do? And she really was sort of at sixes and sevens. She didn't have a plan for her life. And Frank actively encouraged her to think about trying to have a repository for Navajo ceremonial knowledge, because the number of ceremonial singers on the reservation had declined. And what was going to happen to this cultural form. Mm-hmm. And she really convinced Mary to do this, and they became partners in this. And then when Mary met Hosteen Claw, and again, this was through the Newcombs, the story is that she asked him to tell her what he believed in. And through a translator, he told little morality stories that you would tell children so they would know how to behave, what was right, what was wrong. And he told several of these. And at the end of this, Mary supposedly said, I'm serious. I want to know what you believe in. Those are very nice little charming little stories, but I'm serious. I want to understand what you believe in. And his comment to her was, how deep is the ocean? And she loved to sail, and she took this as a sign. And the one thing she also loved about the desert was it reminded her of the ocean, because the horizon is so far removed from you. It's not immediate to you. And so you can really see. And that really started their collaboration and with Frank Newcomb as well and creating this museum.
Okay.
But as I remember reading, he wasn't supposed to really tell her the secrets of his people and of the religion.
Hosting Klaw was the most remarkable man. He was an exceptional singer in terms of his knowledge. During this time period, you know, everything's rote memorization. So as an individual who's apprenticing to be a ceremonial singer, you have to memorize the Navajo creation narratives. You have to know the appropriate prayers. You have to have a medicine bundle or a jish. You have to be able to direct the creation of the dry paintings that are used in the healing ceremonies. You have to know if there are herbal remedies that are going to be needed as part of the ceremony. And so the complexity of this requires years of study. And because of that complexity, a lot of singers learned one or maybe two ceremonies in their entirety. When I first started as a volunteer at the museum in 1995, we were told that Hosting Klaw knew five ceremonies. But if you look at James Ferris's book, The Night Way, you see that Hosting Klaw knew seven ceremonies in their entirety and bits and pieces of other ones that would be similar. There are threads that continue through the various ceremonies. The longest ceremony that he knew, the Night Way, was a 9-night-long ceremony, and it took him 26 years to master all the components. And again, the information we have is that after he had completed his apprenticeship with that, he promised that if he made a mistake, he'd start all over again to learn it. But he, fortunately for all of us, he didn't make an error. But because he was born in 1867, he was not born at Bosque Redondo, but he certainly as a young man growing up realized the loss of traditions and culture that the Navajo people had experienced when they were incarcerated at Bosque Redondo. So this is a theme with him. Also, two of his teachers had shared information with Washington Matthews, who was a U.S. Army surgeon posted out here about ceremonies. So he was not totally unfamiliar with the concept of it. And his apprentice stopped. Depending on the family story, there's one story that he died. The other story is, no, he just quit. He quit learning to be Hosting Klaw's apprentice and left the reservation, and then later on was seen again on the reservation at a later time period. Either way, it was a death to Hosting Klaw because he was old enough by that point in time he didn't have time to teach anybody else.
Okay, so essentially he didn't have anyone to pass it on to.
Right. And Frank Newcomb had been going to ceremonies with Hosting Klaw, highly unorthodox at this time period, you know, the late teens, the early 20s. And she talked to him about she wanted to make reproductions of the dry paintings that are used in the healing ceremonies. And at first he told her no, wasn't appropriate. And then finally he decided to let her. And so he would go with her. They would go to a ceremony, initially the ones that he would be performing. And she taught herself to memorize what she saw them make during the day before the dry painting was used in the ceremony at night. Then she would go outside and sketch what she had remembered. And Hosting Klaw would make corrections. So the issue is, were these corrections so that they were absolutely right or corrections that they were a little off? And I think they were probably corrections that they were a little off, but if a singer looked at the dry painting, they would know what was not quite right and be able to adjust it.
And the point was that the dry painting was destroyed after the ceremonies, right?
Yes. When dry paintings are used as part of the ceremony, at the end of that one night, they are destroyed and taken outside and given back to the earth. So they're not permanent.
By dry painting, do you mean sand paintings?
Yes. Dry paintings it's probably a little more technically correct, okay, of a term, only because it's not just a matter of colored sand. It's a matter of minerals and sometimes herbs and plants that are used as part of the dry painting in the process. Although I use the terms interchangeably, dry painting may be more technically correct as a term. Okay. Hostein-Claw had all of this knowledge, and the Newcombs talked to him about doing textile weavings of the dry paintings because he also was a weaver, not a traditional male role among the Dene, but he taught himself to weave and did those kinds of weavings that would have been used by his extended family as they needed it.
Well, but he wasn't a traditional male. He was one of the women men, wasn't he?
Well, I don't, you know, he's referred to as a Nadle, which is having both male and female characteristics. And I am not an anthropologist enough to be able to go through, you know, what he was or what he wasn't. He did not marry, so he had no children, but he did, you know, had family responsibilities and clan responsibilities. So, but the fact that he decided to weave in and of itself was not a traditional role for men. Although there are male weavers on the reservation, there were then, there continue to be so today. And when he actually became convinced that weaving depictions of the dry paintings that were used in the ceremonies might be okay, it caused a great deal of consternation among other elders and among other singers on the reservation. And they were convinced that something terrible would happen to him because he was making these images permanent and they couldn't be destroyed. And he was clear in stating they were not to take the place of a dry painting. So it isn't like somebody could have taken one of the textiles he wove, put it on the floor of the Hogan, and then used it for ceremonial purposes, mm-hmm, and that it would be okay. And when nothing untoward happened to him, mm-hmm, it sort of elevated his prestige a little bit more in the communities. But there's still controversy among individuals on the reservation as to whether it's appropriate that these images are done in any way, shape, or form. So even though you may see Rainbow Guardian image on baskets or other textiles, there's still some people that don't even think they should be on those because okay, they're okay, not appropriate.
Well, let's go back to Mary Cabot. Okay. Will Wright. Was she pushing to have these things recorded also, or to have the knowledge recorded?
Yes, she used Edison wax cylinder recordings, which was as high tech for the day as you could get. And so she would go places, or she actually had Hostein-Claw come to Los Luceros on at least one occasion, and they would listen to him and transcribe things, record things, transcribe things, and then they'd take a break, and then they'd start back on it again. But she would travel and write. If she didn't have the recorder with her, she would travel and take notes and try to get as many of the creation narrative stories that she could acquire, the information about the ceremonies. And so she and Frances Newcomb in particular would go all over the reservation at any time they heard there was going to be a ceremony when Mary was out here, and together they would go places. And when Mary wasn't here, if Frank heard about a ceremony, she'd go and try to, you know, learn as much as she could about the ceremony. A lot of times they were told to leave. During the time period, if Hostein-Claw was with them, his prestige would gain them entrance to places. And Frank writes about there were times that she and Mary went places and they were basically asked to leave. They were not allowed in. So, and they respectfully did that.
Okay. How did the other members of the community here in Santa Fe look upon this activity? How did they view it?
Well, I think it depends who they were. William Penhallow Henderson and his wife Alice Corbin were very good friends of Mary, and of course William Penhallow Henderson designed the museum. They were very supportive. There were other people in the New Mexico Association on Indian Affairs and in the Eastern Association on Indian Affairs that were very supportive of Mary and what she was doing. The support was not as much evident when the Laboratory of Anthropology was announced to be built here in Santa Fe, and Mary immediately offered to build what was called, what was referred to in the architectural competition as Unit B, the Navajo Hogan, which was to be part of the lab. And Mary knew the Rockefeller family because of their summer homes, the Rockefellers' Seal Harbor on Mount Desert, and Mary had a home on Northeast Harbor right down the coast. And this is where Mary's lack of education sort of gets in the way, because the male scientific community that were responsible for the Laboratory of Anthropology decided that she was not well-educated, she was not scientific enough, and the fact that she was interested in the spiritual ramifications of a culture and spiritual beliefs of a culture, really, it was too mystical and occult for them. And so they ultimately, they through years of arguing back and forth, Mary withdrew her offer to have the museum built as part of the Laboratory of Anthropology.
But all she was doing was offering to pay for the building, right?
Well, Mary being Mary expected it to be what she wanted it to be, which was to reflect Navajo ceremonial life. And there are some great letters back and forth between the trustees talking about the fact, well, let's just tell her we're going to do it the way she wants it. And then once we've got her information that she's collected over the years, then we'll just do whatever we want to with it, you know, and handle it as men can. Well, they did say that they wanted to tell her that they were going to take her collection and then do with it whatever they wanted to. Mm-hmm. And it really was Amelia Elizabeth White who donated the land that the museum's on that allowed Mary to build this museum.
Okay.
And originally it was devoted to, at the time of its opening, you know, this is another example of the scientific community versus Mary. In the Santa Fe New Mexican, when the Laboratory of Anthropology was opened, front page, scientific laboratory opens and all the details about the opening. When Mary has the house blessing ceremony here in 1937, and when the museum finally opens to the public officially in 1938, it's in the society section of the newspaper. And so initially, the museum was called the House of Navajo Religion for 2 years, from 37 to 39. And then Alice Corbin kept lobbying Mary to change the name because people didn't really get what was going on here. And it became the Museum of Navajo Ceremonial Art, and that stayed its name until the mid-1970s.
Okay. We should just say that Amelia White was one of the White sisters, and there is, just down the road from this, is the garden that, in their honor, that I guess is left over from their property.
Yeah, and their property is the home of the School for Advanced Research now on Garcia Street, so El Delirio.
Do you have any idea of what reaction Mary had when the museum was covered in the society section?
That's a great question. There isn't any way to tell. I think she probably would have just taken it in her stride because she had fought to have this museum completed for a number of years. Her timing was always a bit off, too. You know, she started to do something, and then, of course, the stock market crashes. So here they have to deal with waiting till things get on a more even footing. And with the laboratory, it was like 1931, 1932, when she finally withdraws her offer from the laboratory. And then she wants to get started on the building right away when Amelia Elizabeth White gives her the land here, but it takes until 1937 because of a variety of issues. And she was traveling. I mean, we talk about Mary only coming to New Mexico for a while each year. She had a winter home in Mallorca that she went to. She did other traveling to wherever she really wanted to go. In 1934, she went to China with her cousin and other people. And, you know, so she was always looking and trying to learn wherever she was about other cultures' spiritual beliefs. And she read a lot. She refers to herself as being an avid reader. And I think looking at some of the books that she had in her possession, she did. She read a lot.
Okay. Did she leave enough money for the museum to be maintained?
The short answer to that is no. She did have money that she left to the museum, but it really wasn't enough for it to flourish. And we have had great directors, and we've had some that might not be as great, and some of them dipped into the endowment fund to do whatever they felt needed to be done and didn't bother to work to replace the money that they had used. So when she died in 1958, she left between Los Luceros and cash, the museum had roughly $100,000.
Oh, gee.
Yeah. And the Board of Trustees started an endowment in memory of Mary, and they wanted to get it up to $250,000. They came very close to that. But there was no continuing effort to keep building that endowment. Mm-hmm. And so there have been efforts periodically between that time frame. And the most recent one was after 2000, when the library was open, we had an endowment campaign and were able to get it up a little further. But that's a continuing issue here, is to improve the endowment campaign. So,
okay. I know that there are a lot of docents who work here, and so there are a lot of people who are very interested in the museum. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like the people who were behind the founding of it died because they were all about the same age.
Yes, and the museum has changed a great deal since Mary's vision of it as a place where Navajo ceremonial knowledge was available for the Navajo tribe, for practicing singers to come and listen to the ceremonies that she had recorded, to learn from the information that she had accumulated. And in the mid-1970s, our Board of Trustees rightly decided that it was not our place to inform the Navajo people of what their spiritual history was. And we are very proud of the fact that prior to any state or federal legislation, we became the first museum to voluntarily repatriate items to the tribe of origin. So medicine bundles, the jish that Mary had collected from a number of people or families that brought a singer's jish here so that it would be safe, all went to the Ned Hitatli Center at Salie, Arizona. Originally in the gallery, there were 8-foot paintings that were reproductions of various sand paintings, depending on the ceremony. Those were given also to the Ned Hitatli Center. And the focus for the museum really became more contemporary and historic Native American art. Okay. So the museum's name changed to the Wheelwright Museum, and then changed one more time to the Wheelwright Museum of the American Indian. And we certainly pride ourselves on our exhibitions. We originate all of them here. We don't do traveling exhibits. For example, right now and through April 14th, I think, we have great textiles from the Durango Collection from the Center of Southwest Studies in Durango, Colorado, and at Fort Lewis College on display that are historically important between 1860 to 1880, both Navajo textiles and Pueblo textiles. Mm-hmm. And there's also some jewelry on exhibit too, so that the visitor can see how these textiles were worn and how you would be adorned beyond the textile too.
Okay. And does the museum have a collection if they gave away their, essentially, the what was there at the founding?
Yes, we have a collection. We've been working diligently on expanding our jewelry collection. If you come to the museum now, you're going to see a lot of construction because we're building a new 2-story wing off the backside of the museum. The top story will be a jewelry gallery dedicated just to that. So it'll be the first time we'll have a permanent exhibition on display at the museum all the time. Right now, because we change exhibits once a year, there's a 4 or 5 week time period between April and May. There's really nothing in the main gallery for anybody to see if they're coming and to visit the museum. So this is going to allow us to have a permanent exhibition space. It's going to tell the history of jewelry making in the Southwest. It's going to be exquisite. We're going to have some other space downstairs. And always we have the Case Trading Post, which is our museum store where you can find anything you that could, you know, please your heart's desire.
Could you talk about some more about her place in Santa Fe society? I know that she was a friend of O'Keeffe's. She's mentioned in books about O'Keeffe's. Mm-hmm. She was also a friend of Olive Rush. So how did she fit in?
Well, you know, I think because she wasn't here all the time, she's not always recognized as being an important part of the community. When we had our 75th anniversary exhibition, we focused on her role in Santa Fe. Because besides all the collecting that she did that came here to the museum, she donated items to the Indian Arts Fund, which is part of the School for Advanced Research. She donated items to the New Mexico Historical Society. And those items went to all the state museums when the Historical Society donated their collection to the New Mexico museums. She donated items to the Spanish Colonial Arts Society. And she was friends with Mary Austin. So she has this connection with people here on a variety of levels and a variety of issues. And I don't think she's gotten as much positive recognition as she should have. Okay. But again, I think that too is in part because she wasn't here all the time. If she had moved and settled in Santa Fe or the environs, I think it might have been a little different thing. As it was, she maintained contacts with people. Certainly the Hendersons were on that list. Olive Rush visited her in Mallorca one year when she went to Spain. Olive painted designs on two of the fireplaces in Los Luceros. So she had that friendship. She wrote back and forth with Elizabeth White. She wrote back and forth with Margareta Dietrich, who was really one of the stalwart supporters of the New Mexico Association on Indian Affairs. She was involved as a member of the Eastern Association on Indian Affairs, actively involved in securing nurses for the Pueblos. It was one of her causes that was probably an outgrowth of her mother's really sort of spearheading the first school of nursing at Massachusetts General Hospital. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, and when she was interested in things, she sort of threw herself into it full tilt. So she would have been very enthusiastic. Didn't always mean she was perfectly knowledgeable about things. I mean, she would buy things and they would be fakes. There's no two ways around it. But she would have certainly trusted the expert that she was dealing with that it was a legitimate item. Mm-hmm. And she also gave items to the Arizona State Museum, the University of Arizona in Tucson. Then there were things that she did in Maine. She helped fund a woman named Fanny Hardy Eckstorm, who did a series of books both about Native American culture in Maine, but also did one about British ballads that Mary was interested in. She gave items to what was then Society for the Preservation of Historic New England Antiquities, which is now Historic New England. But she gave things to the Massachusetts Historical Society, a diary that her father had left, and also a memoir that her mother had written, gave things to the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. So she was a very generous person. And if you were on her wavelength, you know, with some things, it's like, oh, you're interested in this? Oh, well, I can find something for you here. And the items that she left back east and also at the Abbey Museum in Bar Harbor, Maine, were specific to that area, basically. So she had a basket collection that the Abbey Museum has on portions of it on exhibition on a regular basis. The items that she gave to a Museum of Fine Arts in Boston really were European in nature, and things that she gave to SPNEA were a real mishmash of objects, a lot of textiles and samplers and stuff that they have since deaccessed, so they don't have things in their collection still that she gave. She maintained all these ties and she was active, but again, in terms of her recognition in Santa Fe and New Mexico, it may be a little less than what I think it should be, simply because she wasn't here all the time.
Yeah. It sounds like she was doing so much that she didn't have time to do the kind of dinner party and party kind of things.
She would have hated that dinner party kind of thing, too. I think that's part of the reason she came out here. We started off talking about women leaving the East, coming here, and, you know, it has to be, and it still is in a lot of respect, it's a different sense of freedom and responsibility. So if you were raised in a real strict structure the way she would have been in Boston, there would have been expectations of your daily life, not just overall, but what events you should attend, how you should deport yourself, all of those kinds of things. And you come out here, and if you're coming out here in the 1920s, and even coming out here now, that baggage is back East. You can choose to bring some of it or all of it with you, but it's your choice. And you can really just immerse yourself in what you're interested in. And the one thing that's unusual and remarkable about Santa Fe is there are so many things you can immerse yourself in, whether it's the arts and whether it's Native American art or whether it's there are other artists that you're interested in that are here, whether it's Spanish colonial art. You know, there are so many things that percolate in this town. And Mary was able to tap into what she was interested in. Mm-hmm. It really was Native American focus, and with Spanish colonial arts, you know, that's that Hispanic focus as well. She was friends with Mary Austin. I don't think that would have happened if she hadn't come to Santa Fe. I don't think she would have been in touch with Mary Austin. She certainly would not have built a museum devoted to Navajo ceremonial art. She certainly would not have had the friendship with the Hendersons. So all of those things, really, they were on similar wavelengths, but it was because it was here.
Well, did she keep coming out to New Mexico during the rest of her life?
Yeah, she came out throughout her life, and she was out here in the spring of 1958. She died in July 1958, and so she still came out here and maintained, you know, her museum. She'd always check on what was going on. And but, you know, as it is with a lot of people, you get to a certain point in your life and your close friends are no longer mm-hmm. around. They've predeceased you. Both of the Hendersons died before Mary did. So they really were her sort of her linchpins here in Santa mm-hmm. Fe, keeping her informed about what was going on and what was happening and who was doing what. And she obviously relied on them during the construction of this museum because they were here and she was doing other things.
Mm-hmm. How about Houston DeClow?
He died in 1937 before the museum was finished.
Oh.
So he never got to see it built, but he was involved in discussions with Henderson and Mary about what it could look like and what it should look like. Oh. So we feel comfortable that he was pleased with the building when it was created.
Great.
Mary sold off two homes to help finance this museum. We talked about her little trust that she got interest from that her male cousins controlled. But she rented for a while and ultimately sold her house in Boston. And then she also sold the summer home in Northeast Harbor. And both of those sales of homes were really designed to help in the finance the building of this mm-hmm. museum. Mm-hmm. So these trusts that they had in Boston really were designed so that you could not be ostentatious with your spending. You had to be frugal. But she sold both of those homes. She sold stock from time to time, and in the latter years of her life, her cousin Josiah, who was in charge of the money, worried that she would spend more money than she needed to for the rest of her life, and wrote her little notes and commented to her that he was concerned in how she was spending money because she was financing the museum here. I mean, whatever the difference was with she needed, she made it up. At the museum, she had Los Luceros, which was a financial obligation. She had a summer home still in Maine on Sutton Island called the White Hen. And she traveled and she took people with her. I mean, I mentioned before, she generally had a companion that she traveled with, and there were a variety of people. For a long period of time, it was her cousin, Lucy Cabot. But when Lucy died, she found other people to travel with her. So, and I'm sure that she underwrote a lot of the costs for these other individuals that were traveling with her to Europe or wherever she decided to go. She went to New Zealand in the 50s. If the spirit moved, she went to, I mentioned the China trip in 34. She went to India in 39 and just got out of Indonesia before the Japanese invaded, and got to India and then managed to get back to the United States. But she was pretty fearless, actually. If she got it in her mind that she wanted to go somewhere, she would go. Although there's some great stories about the first time some people met her. They actually heard her at a train station inquiring after the Thomas Cook representative in a loud Bostonian voice, so they knew exactly who she was. So.
Great. Well, thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.